The way you make changes is by shining a light on problems, giving people access to the data, and then making decisions to reduce that risk over time.
Welcome, listeners, to the Industrial Security Podcast. My name is Nate Nelson. I'm here with Andrew Ginter, the Vice President of Industrial Security at Waterfall Security Solutions. He's going to introduce the subject and guest of our show today. Andrew, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Nate. Our guest today is Thomas Pace. He is the co-founder and CEO of NetRise. And our topic is firmware visibility, looking under the hood at the firmware in our devices, looking especially for security weaknesses in that firmware.
Okay. Then without further ado, here's you speaking with Thomas.
Hello, Tom. And, thank you for joining us. Before we get started, can you give us a bit of an introduction? You know, tell us a bit about yourself and about the good work that you're doing at NetRise.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Andrew. Appreciate it. So I'm Tom Pace, co-founder and CEO of NetRise. Some prior experience, I did industrial control system security at the Department of Energy for a handful of years. Then I was a global vice president at Cylance, where I had a myriad of responsibilities, including overseeing our IoT firmware and embedded system engagements for device manufacturers and enterprise customers looking to buy devices alike, as well as being responsible for enhancements to those programs, et cetera. So we essentially took that collective experience and wanted to automate all of that work to provide visibility and risk identification into these devices by doing firmware analysis at scale.
Okay, so you're focused on firmware. I mean, in my understanding, you do firmware in the IT world, you do it in the IoT world, you do it in the OT world. Can we start at the beginning? What is the problem that you're solving here? Why are we looking at this firmware?
Yeah, so I mean, if you think about traditional IT devices, laptops, desktops, servers, things that can support an agent and be, connected to the internet in some capacity, we've had solutions and technologies that have been able to give us visibility into those devices for years, for decades, right? We do not have that same level of visibility and risk identification for these other devices, which essentially exist under this umbrella term of XIoT, extended Internet of Things, which include, IoT, ICS, medical devices, embedded systems in vehicles, satellites, and telecommunications equipment. So what was confusing to me was, why do we not have at least even 10% of the same kind of visibility that we have for laptops, desktops, and servers as our printers, our edge routers, our security appliances, our firewalls, our switches, our security cameras, access points? These are the things that are actually responsible for running our business, ensuring that we're keeping the lights on, et cetera. And yet we can't tell you basically anything about them. We can't tell you what software components are on them. We can't tell you what vulnerabilities exist on those devices. We can't tell you if there's weak credentials or default credentials on those devices in any meaningful way at scale. However, I can tell you every process that's ran on Tom and accounting's laptop over the last year. And that just seemed to be a bit, an uneven representation of the data for those devices in the critical functions that they serve. And that's not even talking about, manufacturing lines and, industrial control systems and PLCs and all of these things that are responsible for pumping billions of dollars of resources through pipelines and building military weapons, et cetera, et cetera. So to us, getting that as close to the same visibility as you can into those devices as we have for, traditional IT devices was, is the big problem that we are going after and one that we are, chipping away at day by day.
So Nate, our topic here is firmware. We're going to look at firmware. Let me ask you, do you know what is the difference between firmware and software? I mean, Thomas gave the example of printers and routers. A lot of today's printers and routers are running Linux. Linux is an operating system. What's the difference between a printer and a computer, given that a printer has a CPU and Linux under the hood?
You know, I don't know if this is obvious, but I guess the difference is just something I've never really considered it too deeply. I've always taken it for granted.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people imagine it's just words, but in fact, there is a difference, and you know, it's almost a legal difference. If you look at you know, something like NERC-SIP, the regulation for the power grid in North America, they define, you know, they say, look, all of your hosts, okay, all of your cyber assets have to have anti-malware. Most people imagine antivirus, but you can use, you know, application control or whitelisting just as easily. You have to have anti-malware installed. Really, how do I install antivirus on my printer? Well, you can't, and you don't even have to. And it's because the printer is not considered to be that kind of cyber asset. And so the difference, in my mind, between firmware and software is not the nature of it. I mean, printers might even have, you know, a stripped down version of Windows under the hood. The difference is that you can't log in and install software and interact with the operating system. In firmware, all you can do is interact with the application. So the printer might have a little web server built in. You can interact with the web server. You might even have users defined on the web server, but these users are not users defined in the underlying operating system. They're users defined in the application. And so this is the difference. A lot of rules and advice that you see in standards and best practice apply to hosts when the host is something that a user can interact with the operating system, install software, run whatever programs they want. And a device does one thing, and the firmware generally comes as a lump. You can't install stuff in the firmware. If you want another version of firmware, you get another lump all in one, and you upgrade the firmware. So that's the difference. Fundamentally, it's the ability to install and run, in a sense, arbitrary applications. We've had a number of guests on the show before talking about, you know, visibility into what's running in the industrial systems. You know, these vendors, they look at network traffic. Some of them have agents that reach out and ask the PLC politely, you know, what version of firmware are you using? Is this the kind of thing you're doing, or are you doing something else?
No, we're doing something very different. By the way, those companies are 100% necessary. I think there's a lot of confusion in the market in terms of, you know, this actually leads to a blog I'm in the middle of writing about who we do not compete with, frankly. You know, we are not competing against the Clarity and the Zomi, a Dragos, like any of those kind of companies. Their role is to identify assets, you know, by doing a device identification, create an asset inventory, and give you as much of that information around, you know, make, model, firmware version as they can, as well as identify threats that are, you know, coming over the network. We view that as addressing the problem from the outside in, right? Totally necessary. We address this problem from the inside out. So in the same way that you wouldn't say, hey, I have a network intrusion detection system, so I don't need to have antivirus. Like, no one says that, right? Because you need to have both. So we are essentially the other side of that coin. So in terms of those companies will go identify these assets, then we can provide the additional data and invisibility into those devices by providing, you know, vulnerabilities, a software bill of materials, a list of misconfigurations, the public keys, the private keys, the certificates, et cetera. Because there's this really big, misrepresentation, assumption here that if I take, to give an analogy or a comparison rather, if I have a Windows operating system and I apply every single patch that is available for that Windows operating system, It's generally agreed that that device has no vulnerabilities anymore, right? There's no more patches to apply to it. Now you have 0 days and you have, you know, hey, this thing can get misconfigured the wrong way and that can allow someone to get access. All of that's true, but there are no inherent vulnerabilities in Windows if you have applied every single patch that are known. That's, I think everybody agrees on that. That is 100% not the case with these devices when you update their firmware. There are a grand total of zero devices in the world. And if there is one out there, I'd love to see it, that if it has a 100%, like the latest firmware updates have been applied, that there are no vulnerabilities. Zero, not one. We have never ran across a device like that ever. And I don't expect to, frankly. And that's not necessarily the end of the world per se, but people are just totally unaware of that. And because they don't have visibility into these devices in the same way. So whenever we talk to people and they say, hey, well, all my firmware is up to date, Tom, which by the way is never the case. Am I safe? And my answer is no. You might be safer, but you're definitely not. That's not the metric. That's not the standard that matters, because there are multiple scenarios. And we're doing a lot of research on this right now to get some better numbers, but where you actually apply a firmware update and it has more vulnerabilities and more risk than the prior version. And you might wonder, well, how can that be the case? Like, why would that happen? The reason that would happen is because device manufacturers, obviously, are always adding new features, new capabilities, new whatever. And so they might, you know, add in these 10 open source components to support the set of capabilities or features. And in so doing, introduce additional risk and vulnerabilities to that device. And so without assessing these things, you're really just flying blind and trusting that the manufacturer is doing the right things, which whenever people tell me that, hey, well, we offload the risk of our devices to our manufacturer, I say, no, you don't. That's not the way risk management works. You don't buy a device, implement it in your environment, and then when something bad happens, you blame the manufacturer. That's not the way life works. I'm sorry. You are responsible for that device now that you own it, and it is your responsibility to secure it. Now, the device manufacturer plays a role in that life cycle, obviously, but that is now your duty of care to make sure that, you know as much as you can about the device and what risk exists within it.
Understanding the risk within it, you've defined the problem, fairly clearly here. You know, patching does not make you invulnerable. How do you help your customers understand the vulnerabilities? Like I said, Nessus scans, in a sense, the device from the outside. You've said you're working from the inside out. How do you do that?
We need to acquire the firmware that is running in these organizations. And we do that from a myriad of multiple different ways. Way number one, we are constantly scraping firmware from everywhere on the internet. So some firmware is just publicly available. Some firmware you need to create an account for. Some firmware you need to have like a contract number. There's various degrees of challenges in obtaining firmware depending on the device type, the manufacturer, et cetera. So that's way number one. We've created a massive firmware library that is greater than 1 million unique firmware images. Way number two is we rely on the end customer to upload the firmware into our platform. So now, to be clear, we are not asking our customers to go and rip firmware off of every single unique device that's in their environment. That is totally unreasonable, not scalable, and just wildly difficult in many scenarios. So what we do ask them to do is to download the firmware from their manufacturer, acquire, whatever means that is, and then upload it into our platform for analysis. And so we don't necessarily need, as I mentioned, the unique firmware for each individual device. So say you have, 10 Cisco switches, and they're all running the same version of firmware. We only need one version of that so that we can give you the full-blown analysis that covers all of the other things. So those are the primary ways. And then obviously the other way we would get it is by working with the device manufacturers themselves. So we're doing both.
Okay. So that's interesting. We, you know, you or someone gets your system a copy of the firmware. Your system analyzes the firmware. When you do that, what do you find? What's the output?
So we provide a very comprehensive set of data and artifacts that can be used for, you know, a myriad of things. Number one, the most important thing that we provide is really the foundation of everything that we are doing at NetRise is an SBOM, a software bill of materials. So, and we provide that in the most common formats, Cyclone DX and SPDX. And that basically gives you a list of components that we were able to identify, which would include, but not be limited to, applications, packages, the Linux kernel, if they're, you know, whatever kernel is running. And then along with those list of components, we provide all of the vulnerabilities that we've been able to identify for those components. And that's just not coming from the NVD. The NVD is one source of data, obviously. There's multiple other sources of data that we leverage. We provide exploits that are available for those vulnerabilities. We provide a ton of additional context related to both the components and the vulnerabilities associated with those components. In addition, we provide a list of binaries that are in a firmware image, whether or not they have different binary hardening mechanisms in place that are, you know, mitigations against exploits. We provide a list of all of the usernames and passwords and credentials that we can find across the entire firmware image, not just in, like, you know, Etsy password and the common places you find things. We detect credentials and hashes throughout the entire firmware image. We also identify all of the public keys, private keys, and certificates and do all of the analysis on those to determine, are they out of date? Are they expired? Are they invalid for a number of reasons? We also provide all of the misconfigurations that could exist or configuration settings. Like, there's key configuration settings that we analyze. And so, you know, if there are scenarios where, you know, you have multiple users with UID 0 or you have SE Linux disabled, whatever, there's a number of things we can analyze there. We also provide you with, you know, a robust, like, search and querying interface. We give you a risk score. We give you access to the file system. So it's a really comprehensive set of data that we're able to provide, you know, users with to take action on in a number of different ways.
It's clear that you know, there's value both for end users and for the vendors. You know, our sweet spot here on the show is industrial security. I know that you serve a lot of different industries, but, you know, you serve the OT, the operational technology, the industrial control system market as well. When you analyze, like, PLC firmware and other firmware that you find in industrial contexts, what are you finding? What's sort of the headlines that you're finding when you look at this stuff?
As it always is, it depends on the kind of thing you're looking at. But when you look at devices that are running, I mean, we break things into two categories for us at this point, which are really kind of like real-time operating systems and embedded Linux. Embedded Linux firmware is going to have much more data available to it, obviously, right? Has a full-blown file system, has all of the things you would come to expect from basically a normal operating system. Whereas RTOS is significantly less data. I mean, you're talking about, you know, essentially in some cases, one binary that you have to kind of parse through and rip out additional components and certificates and things like that. But, you know, we find a ton of hard-coded credentials that we are able to break. You know, like, even if they're like SHA-512 hashed, we're able to, you know, get the plain text of those things. That's pretty common. We find a ton of firmware that has both the public key and private key for the same key pair, unencrypted, in the firmware. We find that incredibly often. And then, you know, we also find software components that are magnificently out of date in these firmware images, which obviously also creates the scenario where you're going to have a significant number of vulnerabilities associated with these components. And I'm talking about, we might be looking at a firmware version that's brand new, like could have came out this morning, and we'll upload that firmware and there'll be software components that are 10 years old on that firmware image. Is there good reasons for that? I suppose so, from a business perspective, maybe, like time to market, and you understand how these binaries and applications are going to work within your device. You don't have to go through all this regression testing and things like that. And then oftentimes we'll hear from folks things like, well, hey, we're not even using that component. And I usually just pause for a minute and let them think about that on their own. Then why is it there? So why, if you're not using this thing, then why is it present in this device? So that would be some of the things we identify. I mean, we also, as it relates to the misconfigurations, we find a ton of really interesting things around, how different configuration settings can like be related to one another and how that can introduce risk. So if we find vulnerabilities that are memory corruption vulnerabilities, and we find binaries that do not have particular binary hardening, configuration settings built in, that we correlate that information together. So that should either increase or decrease the risk overall of those things. But there's not been a single image or firmware, that we've taken a look at that has not had, a number of interesting findings.
Cyber attacks with physical consequences more than doubled in 2021. For industrial victims, the most common consequences were production outages at multiple sites. Most of the attacks were ransomware. And 2021 saw the first cloud-based ransomware attack. That attack compromised 1,500 businesses in the space of 45 minutes. These and other insights are included in a new threat report, co-authored by Waterfall Security Solutions and the new ICS Strive Industrial Incident Repository. For your copy of the report, please visit icsstrive.com. That's ICSSTRIVE.com.
Andrew, as somebody who myself doesn't have a software development background, why is it that you would have unuseful components to begin with?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. The bottom line is that it costs money to remove these things. I mean, let's say you're using a standard stripped down Linux distro. There's sort of lots of embedded Linux distros out there. You're using one of these, and it comes with a gazillion stuff built in. It takes effort to get rid of that stuff. And every time you upgrade the distro, it takes effort to get rid of, more of it, or to get rid of the new versions of it. And so, if something is sort of doing no harm and is part of something else, there's a lot of software involved in these products. You tend to just leave it there because, you're not adding features. You're not making the product more sellable by cleaning up and getting rid of stuff that you're not using. You make the product more sellable by increasing, by adding features, by increasing performance, but you don't make it more sellable by getting rid of stuff nobody's using.
Fair enough, but then couldn't you be actively detracting from the quality of software? For example, if you have a component that does something that maybe you're not aware of because you don't focus on it, because you don't use it, or a component that communicates in some way to the outer world, that it could create a security risk. So wouldn't it be in the benefit of this theoretical company's software to actively look out for stuff like that and then excise it?
Yeah, I mean, there's two answers there on the risk side. One is that every change that you make to the software is also a risk of malfunction. If you remove a component that you think you're not using anymore, and in fact, you just didn't understand the millions of lines of code that is your product, and you remove something that is vital in an emergency, but you don't see it used all the time because you don't have emergencies all the time. You've actually increased your risk by removing the thing. On the other hand, removing stuff that is truly not needed, if you can spend the effort to figure out that it really truly is not needed, you're spending effort getting rid of that stuff. Determining that it's really truly not needed, you know, in a large system can be costly. And again, how much more product are you selling as a result of that? You know, it's in a sense, it's a cold calculus saying, I've only got so much money I can invest in the next version of the product, and I'd better invest it in a way that's going to help me sell the product. You know, how's it going to help you sell by removing stuff that nobody even knows is there? Now, you know, that said, this kind of stuff that, you know, NetRise and others are doing in terms of looking under the hood and telling everyone what's in the software, if the end users, the owners and operators, start using these facilities and they truly look at stuff and say, you know, I don't like all of these vulnerabilities in this product. This one is much cleaner. And they start buying the cleaner one instead of the dirty one. Now, the investment that you're making in cleaning out the old stuff is in fact removing an impediment to sales. And you can justify making that investment. So, you know, a lot of people say, oh, the vendors are making money hand over fist. Well, you know, they're also spending money hand over fist, and they have to make business decisions about how the money they spend is going to either result in more sales or address impediments to sales. And, this visibility thing that's happening is, in a sense, changing that landscape for the vendors. These findings, can I ask, again, on the industrial side, in a sense, who's the most interested in looking at their firmware? I mean, I ask because, you know, imagine, I don't know, automobile manufacturing or consumer goods manufacturing. Those factories, the control systems, in my experience, tend to be very tightly integrated with the IT networks. There's a lot of exchange back and forth. There's a lot of exposure for the control system to the IT network. And so because of the exposure, you might imagine that industries are more interested in finding out how vulnerable their firmware is. On the other hand, you know, something like, I don't know, railway, passenger rail switching systems are deeply buried behind layers and layers of security. They're obviously more critical than, I don't know, consumer goods manufacturing. But they're so heavily buried behind other layers of defenses. Which of these industries is more interested in their vulnerabilities? Is it stuff like the rail system because of the criticality? Is it, you know, stuff like the consumer goods because of the exposure, or, you know, is it something else? Who seems to be the most interested in this?
A couple ways to answer your question. I'll answer initially the most direct way. We have device manufacturers reaching out to us on a weekly basis, asking if we can generate SBOMs for their firmware for, I would say, 2 to 3 primary reasons. Reason number one, in no particular order, the executive order and being able to provide SBOMs to the federal government. Now, that's just in the United States, by the way. One has to imagine other governments are going to probably follow suit, as they tend to do. The second issue, or the second reason, rather, is customer demand or customer requests. So whenever I hear people and I read these folks who are writing stuff about, like, oh, people don't care, I'm just like, man, I mean, obviously, I'm not going to make my emails and conversations with customers public. But sometimes I wish I could, to show the demand that we are seeing. Like, a giant publicly traded device manufacturer isn't reaching out to us to create an SBOM because they're bored. Let me tell you, that's not what's happening. They're doing it because customers are asking for them, and because they want to be able to sell to the federal government and be able to meet those standards. So that's a direct way of answering it for the device manufacturer, at least. Now, we are seeing a significant uptick in requests for SBOMs as it relates to like electrical utility companies and critical manufacturing and all of those as well. So that's just happening. Now, to answer your question about the either or, like you have the consumer goods or you have like the railway devices. We've actually talked with multiple companies. We've actually talked with multiple railway companies even. The risk management process and framework that those companies have to go down is just totally different, right? The railway companies are basically evaluating risk using a consequences driven model. Whereas the other companies are using more of a traditional risk management framework. How much risk is present in this device? Okay, if this device gets compromised, like, all right, somebody writes an article about us on Ars Technica and we all move on. But if I am, a railway operator in the US and somebody compromises, this device, this switching device, people die, a train gets routed down the wrong tracks, et cetera, et cetera. And Andrew, you know this probably better than me, quite frankly. This idea that all of these devices are properly segmented and hidden behind the layers that everybody hopes and dreams they are is just inaccurate. Are there some companies that do that and do it very, very well? Obviously, that's true. Is that the exception and not the rule? In my experience, it is. But there are certain industries where that's more or less, better implemented. Like, the nuclear industry as an example. Like, they do a pretty good job of making sure things are pretty segmented. I think you're probably right. In fact, Andrew, about the railway industry, I think they seem to do a very, very good job about making sure things are where they should be. There's exceptions, of course. Then you look at hospitals. How good of a job do they do? Debatable. It's just they're under-resourced and all the normal problems you have in those kinds of industries. So it's really the use cases can be quite different, even for companies doing kind of the same thing, because a company making a security camera just is not going to have the same kind of consequences as a company making a device that is responsible for, operating a plane or a train or something like that. So the same level of effort, resources, and capital are just not going to be invested.
Now, Andrew, maybe this isn't something that you asked Thomas directly, but why would we be worried about vulnerabilities in PLCs? I mean, I know that we should be worried about vulnerabilities in general, but it's, in my dim understanding from what we've talked about in past episodes, these connections are not encrypted. So if you're in a network and you could tell any PLC to do anything, then what's the point of worrying about like a hole and what amounts to like plain text communication?
The answer is that A, this is changing. We are seeing crypto capabilities increasingly deployed. So this is, in a sense, looking at the future. B, I think part of the answer is that we're talking about layers. It's not a flat network in your industrial control system where everything can talk to everything. There are layers, there are firewalls, there's segmentation. And the higher level layers, the ones that are closest to the IT network, tend to use cryptographic capabilities the most extensively. This is the layers where printers sit. This is the layers where a lot of devices sit that feel IT-like. And that's the layer where you kind of expect stronger security. If you go through another three layers of firewalls straight down into the PLCs, it's a different world down there. But, you're responsible for security across the entire system. And so certainly in the higher layers and increasingly in the lower layers, everybody cares about this. And it's not just PLCs that we're looking at. There's a lot of devices increasingly on these networks. We're seeing cameras, we're seeing video monitoring, we're seeing all sorts of stuff. So I do think it's relevant, but I guess I should have asked the question. And let me ask you, if I may, how long has NetRise been doing this? You've looked at a lot of firmware. Have you been doing this long enough to see trends? How are we doing? You know, are we getting better at this, especially in the industrial space?
NetRise just hit its 2-year anniversary at the beginning of December, which is exciting. I mean, it's not a super long time to be around, but boy, oh boy, have we been busy. You know, our product basically, we announced the GA in August of this year, but obviously we've had our platform around much longer than that. You know, testing and development and all that fun stuff. So I would say the state of affairs is not great. I see no indication yet from a quantitative data perspective that things are getting better. Now, I have to, I'm not necessarily caveating this, but the fact that a company like ours can even exist and be successful is indicative that the industry is moving in a positive direction, right? Like, that has to be the case. Otherwise, why do we have a company, right? If we're not doing well, then the industry is just clearly not advancing. We approach this problem as a data problem. And so the way we're able to like correlate information across different devices, verticals, et cetera, gives us some very, very fascinating insights into all manner of things. And it's going to take an incredibly long time for this stuff to move in a super, super positive direction. And I have no reason to believe that industrial control systems will probably take, I don't know if you would say the longest, but probably close to the longest, right? And that's like not a shot at those OEMs, and that's not what it is at all. They have a magnificently difficult problem. You know, it's not the same as, hey, I need you to update this software component on this security camera. The device manufacturer just does that. Okay, here you go. It's updated. That's not the way it works in ICS and OT devices, right? Things have to go through all this like safety testing and you know, regression testing, making sure you have to account for every possible scenario. Do the fail safe still work properly? If the temp, like all these things that matter in ICS that don't matter in like consumer devices or, you know, even some medical devices or whatever it is, are of critical importance in the industrial control system device space. So, but yeah, I mean, the more data we tend to get our hands on, Andrew, doesn't lend itself to things looking super optimistic right this second. But that's how you make changes. The way you make changes is by shining a light on problems, giving people access to the data, and then making decisions to reduce that risk over time. It's you know, people always are looking for an easy button and to be able to solve a problem instantaneously. Like, this is not going to be that. It just isn't. So progress is being made, like I said, but we've got a long road.
We've talked about sort of the state of what you're seeing in the industrial market. You've got a lot of data, though. I mean, you've talked about millions of firmware images. You know, what do you see in that data? What do you see that we don't? What can we learn from this data?
Yeah, I think one of the fundamental problems we have, especially as it relates to ICS and OT devices, is answering this question that cannot be answered right now in a meaningful way. Where else can this happen? So, great example that I've talked about a handful of times is, you know, the pipe dream stuff. Great research done by, you know, Drago, SZA, Mandiant, where they identify, you know, this vulnerable component And they actually enumerate a number of PLCs that were impacted by this. Like I think it was primarily Omron and Schneider Electric stuff. And there's a big, it's a list, like it might be like 20 devices total amongst both manufacturers. Would everyone agree that that is a pretty decent problem? I would think so, right? Those devices do very important things at very important companies. Great. So we've come to that agreement, I think. What they point out, which is something I've been saying for a very long time, is, okay, we know that these problems exist in these devices, but the underlying issue is from a component that is known to exist in hundreds of other devices. And so the next question is pretty simple, right? Well, what are those hundreds of other devices? That is a question that we cannot answer. Now, we can answer it, but that requires us to have the firmware for all of those devices, obviously, right? We can't answer a question without the data. Like you don't have this problem with Windows or something, right? You know, these are the components that are on Windows. If this problem exists over here, it obviously exists in all of these other devices. That level of visibility does not exist in the OT and ICS space. So as it comes to incident response, like we know how, when something bad happens somewhere, it's very easy for us to answer at this point, how and why did this happen? We know how to do incident response. We know how to do patient zero identification. We know how to do root cause analysis. We can figure out how and why this thing happened. The next question is where else can this happen based on those other answers? And that is a magnificent challenge, unless you have all the data in one place that could be queried. Now, that's what we've done, right? For any data point that we identify, whether it's malicious or not malicious, but risky or not risky, we give you the ability to identify where else does this thing exist in the entire data set that is available to you. So if we find a vulnerability, you can just literally click on a button and it says, like, show me where else this is, and ta-da, there it is. We give you all the devices that also have that, whatever it is, vulnerability, binary, whatever it is. So that is a problem that is massive, difficult to solve, but is coming into the public forum and discourse finally, which I think is, once again, the first step, right? Recognizing, acknowledging that a problem exists is the only way that you're going to hope to solve it. So moving in the right direction.
You know, a question I did not ask Thomas and I regret a little bit, is a question about, you know, this answer he gave. He pointed out that, you know, Pipedream listed, a couple of dozen devices that they knew were affected. They listed the component that they knew was affected, but they did not have, you know, the Dragos did not have a complete list of all devices in the world that had that component as part of the device. And it strikes me that this is an opportunity. If you've got a system like the system at NetRise, and you've got a system like, you know, Industrial Defender or, you know, Verve or Nozomi or Dragos, whatever, installed that can give you an asset inventory, you'd kind of like to take the output of the asset inventory system and feed it into the NetRise system and say, not what are the 73,000 devices out there that might be in trouble. You want to ask, how many of those devices do I have? Here's the devices I have. You tell me how many of my devices have this problem. That strikes me as an opportunity. And I didn't ask if NetRise already does this or, you know, it's on the roadmap or whatnot, but it strikes me as sort of a mind meld of these two kinds of worlds. Well, thank you, Tom. This has been eye-opening for me. Before we let you go, can you sum up what should our listeners take away from what you've been telling us?
Yeah, I think the number one takeaway here is it is possible to get the same or pretty close to the same level of visibility that you have for your laptops, desktops, and servers for your OT and ICS devices. Now, is it using a different approach? Are there edge cases and caveats and all these other things? Like, of course that's the case. But this idea that we are not able to gain insight and visibility into these devices, that I think has been a common misconception for a very long time, is just not accurate. I think most people are just totally unaware that there is even an option to get this kind of visibility and depth of analysis at scale. And so, you know, this idea that you have to go and do all these like manual engagements and interrogate each individual device to get these kind of answers is just not reality any longer. And so, yeah, I mean, the number one takeaway here, I think, is that visibility is possible.
Andrew, that was your interview with Thomas. You got a last word to bring us out with?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the world is changing. Back in the day, we used to have to pay a security guru to do an assessment of one device. This was expensive. It was slow. It used to be that vendors had end user license agreements that forbade analyzing their firmware, that forbade this kind of assessment. What we're seeing here is that the world is changing. Customers are demanding this kind of visibility. Government customers in many jurisdictions are refusing to buy stuff if they can't see inside and understand the supply chain, and if they can't get some transparency here. You know, money talks. If the customers are demanding this kind of visibility, it's starting to happen. You know, this is a marvel to me. I mean, I look at this and go, wow, this is very different from the software development, the product development world that I lived in 15 years ago when I was doing product development. But this kind of transparency it's a good thing. It is helping make the world safer. So, to me, this is just the fact that we're even having this conversation. This is progress.
Great. Well, then, thanks to Thomas Pace for bringing all this up with us, and thank you, Andrew, for speaking with me today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Nate.
This has been the Industrial Security Podcast from Waterfall. Thanks to everybody out there listening.